more torches to the barricade. In the midst of the chaos, a group of three hissing Yaeters shoved their way through the mob. One clawed Gillen across the face. The other two knocked Willa to the ground. The teeth of the attacking Yaeters chattered with anticipation as they came at her. The flames of the Padawan's torches burned upward, joining together and scorching the walls.
"If you try to get in here, you're all going to burn!"
the Padawan shouted at the rioters as he retreated into his private dens. One of the torches fell and hit the woven stick floor, catching it aflame. As the fire spread across the floor and walls, the great hall of the Padawan began to fill with smoke, and screams of terror rose up from the chaos of the crowd. Chapter 67 Willa found herself engulfed in a wave of running, screaming people and burning flames. A foot hit her in the head. Another foot stepped on her back. She tried to get up, but the running crowd trampled over her. Crushed to the floor, she looked over to see Gillen fighting to get closer. "Gillen!" Willa cried as she reached for her. For a moment, their fingers touched, and they were almost able to grasp each other's hand. But then the mob swept Gillen away like the current of a great river, and she was gone. Filled with new determination, Willa growled and tried to get up, only to be knocked down again. Finally, someone in the crowd stopped to help her. He held her arm and pulled her up onto her feet. She could finally breathe. She got her legs underneath her and was able to stand. Someone was saving her life. She turned with hope in her heart, but then saw Gredik's face and felt his hands clamp painfully onto her arms. "You're coming with me, Willa," he snarled as he dragged her through the fleeing crowd. Willa tried to yank away, but it made no difference. He held on to her tighter than he had ever held her before, as if he knew this was his last chance. He wasn't going to let her go. The fear boiling up inside her, she fought and flailed against him, but he was far too strong. He dragged her out of the burning hall of the Padawan and down one of the smoky side corridors. Angry at her resistance, Gredik slammed her up against a wall and pinned her with the force of his body.
"Stop it, Willa!"
Gredik shouted into her face. She couldn't move. She couldn't breathe. He pushed against her so hard that it was like a rock had fallen against her.
"The lair is going to burn," he said,
his tone ragged with fear.
"Do you understand me? It's all going to burn. But you and I are going to stop fighting each other."
Willa could see what was happening. He'd lost his twin brother and his Yaeter allies, and now he was alone, which terrified him more than anything he had ever faced. His instinct now was to clan together, even with someone he hated.
"We are going to escape. We are together now, Willa."
She could see the violence in Gredik's eyes, the need to control, to dominate. But more than anything, she could hear the desperation in his voice. She tried to jerk away from him, but he held her firm, pressed against the wall.
"We are together now, Willa," he said again, as if he could force the thought into her mind.
She knew there was no way out of this. He was never going to let her go. And even if she managed to escape him, he'd follow her. He was going to hunt her down. She needed a different way, a different path. She could only see one way out. Sometimes you had to do things you didn't want to do, things that went against everything you had ever done before. She stopped fighting him. She became very still, and she looked into his bloodshot eyes.
"All right," she said, nodding her head in agreement. "We'll leave together, through the labyrinth to my old den. I know a way out of there."
Gredik grunted
pleased that she was finally beginning to cooperate with him. But he clutched her arm, wary of a trick, and shoved her along in front of him like one of the human prisoners. She tried to wrest her arm away from him, but he wouldn't let her go. He pushed her and dragged her down through the tunnels of the lair, leaving the smoke and flames and shouting behind them.
"The whole lair is burning up there," she said in dismay. "We're going to make it on our own," Gredek said. "We're together now," he repeated with a clinging insistence that sent a cringe down her spine.
When they finally reached the labyrinth, she guided him down through the stone tunnels that led toward her den. When he realized she was leading them in the right direction, she felt his grip on her arm relax a little. She stumbled and collapsed to the floor. Gredek reflexively reached down to pull her to her feet. She leapt up and sprang away from him with all her speed. But he reached out just as quick, grabbed her by the hair, yanked her back, and pulled her off her feet. She screamed in pain as she fell backward and hit the floor, banging her head hard.
"You're not going to escape, Willa!"
Gredek rasped as he pinned her to the ground with his hand gripping her neck. Her refusal of his offer, her rejection of him, had filled him with rage.
"You're going to regret the choice you've made trying to get away from me again. I can see now the nasty little lying beast that you really are. But you're not as smart as you think you are. After I'm done with you here, I'm going to track down those three little humans of yours that you seem to care so much about. You forget how long we've been together, Willa. I know exactly where you hid them. And after I'm done with you here, I'm going to track them down and make sure they never get home."
Willa exploded with anger and squirmed from his grip, twisting her body and knocking his clutching hands away. She leapt up and darted out of his reach, then sprinted down the corridor. She followed the winding passageway, but she could hear his footsteps coming behind her. There was no way to outrun him for long, and he was too close for her to blend into the rock wall. She turned down the tunnel on the left, then turned to the right. Gredek followed right behind her, growling with anger. When she came to the end of the long, winding tunnel and took the passageway on the left, she did it knowingly. But when she felt the air turning cold, her chest seized with panic despite herself. It was a choice she could not come back from. The blackness of the abyss was just steps away. She came to the edge of the dark hole at the end of the tunnel, and there was nowhere else to go. She was trapped. The hole of the abyss fell hundreds of feet down into pitch darkness. No one knew how deep it was, or if it even had a bottom. Gredek lunged forward and clutched her with his bony hands. He had grabbed her so many times over the years. She had fought him for so long. But this time, she didn't try to leap away. She didn't try to dodge him or fight him. As he charged forward, she pulled him into her, wrapped her arms around him, and held on.
"I'm going to track them down and make sure they never get home," Gredek had said.
And that was his mistake. She leaned way back.
"We are together now, Gredek," she whispered into his ear.
In a flailing spasm of wild panic, Gredek tried to escape her embracing arms. But it was too late. The two of them fell together. Chapter 68. Willa fell through the black darkness of the abyss. Her mind screamed with fear that these were the last seconds of her life. She felt the sensation of falling in her stomach and her limbs. Her hair floated around her head. The cold air rushed past her, touching her cheeks, her arms, her legs, getting colder as she fell, deeper into the darkness. Gredek had let go of her, and she had let go of him. She knew he must be falling with her, but she could not see him. When she hit bottom, the force of the blow struck her so hard that it sent splitting bolts of pain through her ribs. The crash bludgeoned her face as she splashed down into the churning rapids of an underground river. Her body plunged deep into the water, propelled by the force of her fall. There was no up or down, just wild spinning and tumbling over and over as the current took hold of her and swept her away. Willa tried to pump her arms and her legs, tried to swim to what she thought was the surface and take a gasp of desperately needed air, but the river was far too powerful. It hurled her through its twisting underground tunnels, flowing through watery caves and narrow chutes. There was no surface to reach. No air, just water flowing through stone. But she was not alone. She had inside her everything every creature of the forest had ever taught her. She was everything every friend had given her. She was a soaring hawk and a roaring panther. She was a healing bear and a running wolf. But most importantly at this moment, she was a river otter. She stopped fighting the water, stopped trying to swim against the current, stopped trying to exert her will. She tucked herself smooth and let herself be taken with the flow, slipping through the water, with the water, part of the water, like her teachers had taught her. Twist and turn, slip and slide. The water was her domain. There was no up or down, left or right. There was only one direction, the flow of the river. And she propelled herself through it as fast as she could, knowing that her only hope lay on the other side of the darkness, the other side of the caves and tunnels through which she moved. She didn't need eyes or ears or other senses. She only needed to go where the water wanted her to go, and get there as quickly as possible. The flow of the river hurled her into a cave with a pocket of air. At last, her head broke the surface of the water. She pulled in a blessed breath, filling her lungs with the cold, damp air of the cave. Then she held her breath and went back under, continuing through the next tunnel until she reached the cave on the other side. The underground river finally emerged out of the caves and poured fast and smooth through what felt like a world of giant boulders. Floating easily on the current now, with her head well out of the water, she pulled in long, grateful breaths of air. Above the water and the boulders and the trees that lined the river, a thousand stars cast their glistening light across the nighttime sky. She had never been more relieved to be alive. Something floating in the water bumped her shoulder. Startled, she flinched away from it and turned to defend herself. But when she realized what it was, her heart filled with a different kind of dread. Gredek's body was floating down the river with her. He had drowned, fighting what could not be fought. She knew she should have been happy to see him dead. But she wasn't. The Yaders had been shattered. Kiernan had died days before. Kyderg and at least a dozen others had been killed in the battle. And now Gredek was gone as well. She knew she should have been filled with triumph that she had defeated her enemies. But loneliness darkened her soul. Gredek and the other Yaders had been members of her clan. She had known them all her life. A memory from years before came into her mind. Just after her sister and parents died, she and Gredek were pulled into the Yaders. The Padawan and his guards took her and Gredek out into the forest alone for their initiation. By the time the guards were done with them, she and Gredek lay exhausted and bleeding on the forest floor. Yaders weren't born. They were made. Willa remembered lying there in the dirt and the leaves, looking over at Gredek on the ground a few feet away from her. Wincing in pain, she got up onto her feet, and then she helped him up as well. He limped a few feet away, picked up two long, spear-like sticks from the forest floor, and put one of them into her hand.
"We don't give up, Willa," he said to her.
As she floated down the river with Gredek's body beside her, Willa treaded water over to the river's edge, reached up to the low-hanging trees, and pulled a stick from the branches. Moving through the water back over to him, she opened Gredek's cold, white fingers, wrapped them around the stick, and then let the current take him downstream with his spear in hand.
"We don't give up, Gredek," she whispered.
She was left drifting down the river alone now, beneath a jet-black sky and a spray of stars. It was quiet, almost peaceful, but there was a faint orange light flickering on the smooth surface of the river. Still treading water, Willa turned and looked back, up the slope of the great mountain. It felt like it was always there, always watching. The Dead Hollow lair was on fire. It was a great blaze of snaking flame and black smoke rising upward into the midnight sky. From a distance, it almost looked like the great mountain itself was burning. Chapter 69. Leaving Gredek to float down the river without her, Willa crawled up onto the rocky bank. The night air hung about her in a drifting haze of gray smoke and orange flickering light. That was when she noticed something dripping onto the ground. It was her own blood. Over the past few hours, she'd been speared in the neck, dragged on the floor, slammed against a wall, kicked in the side, and stepped on. Now that she'd come out of the cold water of the river and the all-consuming urgency of escape had faded behind her, her body began to hurt in places she didn't even realize could feel pain. Hialeah had bandaged the bloody wound on her neck, and the twisting roots of the floor had infused her body with a startling jolt of vital power. But she knew that she was losing too much blood. She couldn't make it very far in this wounded condition. She gazed up toward the burning lair. She didn't want to go back up there, but there was a chance that one area of the lair in particular had survived the fire, and that it could help her. She climbed hand over hand, up through the rocks and trees, toward the blaze. She watched as the flames consumed one area after another, the crackling of the burning sticks and the rush of the fiery wind drowning out all else, as the odor of burning wood filled the air.
"Do not say it out loud until you wish to destroy everything."
Her mamma's warning about saying Nalik echoed in her mind. Her old den, the great hall, the homes of all the Faerun people were being destroyed by the fire. She couldn't help but feel the weight of it as she climbed. By the time she reached Dead Hollow, most of the lair had burned down into ruined, smoking piles of charred wreckage, the dry sticks of its old walls and floors providing ample fuel for its own destruction. Where once there had been a vast hive of twisted stick tunnels and rooms, now there was nothing left but the blackened remains of disintegrated walls and heaps of smoldering ashes. All the Faerun of the clan had fled the lair to escape the fire, so the entire area was abandoned, and most of what remained was unrecognizable. But there was one small part of the lair at the bottom of the gorge where the fire could not go. And that was what she was hoping for. She climbed through the ashes and debris until she reached the lowest, oldest part of the lair. She had been in this area just a few hours before with Gredek, but now it looked completely different. All the woven stick passageways and walls were burned away, and all that remained was the labyrinth of stone tunnels and ancient caves where she and her mamma had lived. Willa climbed down inside, and then made her way through the tunnel that led to her den, down the passageway with the painted figures of the Farron past. Despite the burning that had occurred above, the paintings on the stone walls had survived. She came to the river of souls, thousands of hands touching the wall, her mother's and her father's, Aliyu's and her own, the left and the right, the forward and the back, all together. W-I-L-L-A and A-L-L-I-W, she thought, remembering the strange human symbols. "Good morning, sister," she said, touching her living hand to her sister's handprint as she walked by. "I'm glad you made it through." Finally, Willa came to the den where her mamma had raised her. Those areas of the floor that had been made out of woven sticks had burned and were gone, and the intense heat of the surrounding conflagration had melted and destroyed their cocoons and all their other belongings. Most of the small trees and other plants that her mamma had nurtured in the small circles of light were wilted from the heat and dead. All except one. The little tree was still alive. She sighed with happiness and smiled. It was sitting in a stone pot on a stone ledge, protected and safe in its little niche. It was an ancient tree, miniature in size, its small branches gnarled with age, but its tiny leaves were green with living spirit. Her heart warmed to see that the little tree was waiting for her. "Hello, my friend," she said as she moved closer. "I know it's probably been difficult to breathe these last few hours, but don't worry. I'll get you someplace safe, with plenty of light and water and nutrients." She took several of the leaves that had fallen from the tree and pressed them to the wound at her neck. The relief from pain was immediate. She felt the intense power of the tiny plant surging into her skin, through her muscles, and deep down into her blood. One by one, she treated the most painful of her wounds. "Thank you, Mamma," she whispered softly, not just for nurturing and protecting the little tree all these years, not just for teaching her how to use it, and for the many other gifts of the mind that she'd given her, but for the love that had come with it. "Protect it. Hold on to it," her mamma had pleaded with her before she died. Willa hadn't understood at the time, but she knew now that her mamma wasn't telling her to hold on to the little tree, or to the secret of Nalik's forbidden name, or even to the ancient lore of the forest. She was imploring her to hold on to what was in her heart, her love, her compassion, her sense of her soul. Not just her instinct to blend, but sometimes her willingness to stand up and make herself known, to throw the spear, to spring the trap, to set things in motion that cannot be undone. Her mamma had been watching the decline of the Dead Hollow clan for many years, and Willa came to realize what her mamma already knew, that the Dead Hollow clan hadn't started dying because of the arrival of the Dayfolk, but with the rise of the Padawan who came after. The quelling of the Farron words, the disconnection from the forest, the drowning of love and compassion and sympathy in a swarm of fear and malice and control. Without love, there could be no families, no children, no elders. There could be no future. As she held the little tree, she came to a realization, something that she didn't think she could have understood before. For years, her mamma had been unable to fight against the growing power of the Padawan and his control of the Farron people. To go against him meant death. Willa realized now that she herself had been her mamma's last try. She was her last hope, to live and to love and to follow the path of the heart.
"I'll protect it, Mamma. I swear I will. I'll protect what's in my heart," Willa whispered in the old language. "I'll never let it go."
Willa carried the little tree slowly up and out of the old stone tunnels and walked through the ashes until she reached what was once the center of the Dead Hollow lair. She looked around her at the vast gray field of ashes. Her premonition that she would never again see the Hall of the Padawan, the Hall of the Glittering Birds, had been correct. The once magnificent walls of the great hall had burned and crumbled down. The hall wasn't just empty or damaged. It was gone. The great throne of the Padawan had burned into a charred, blackened heap. She stepped slowly forward into the area that had been behind the throne. She began to make out a dark shape on the ground. It was burned and blackened, but she could see the outline of what was once a leg and the oblong mass of a scorched and smoldering head. The knees and elbows were folded up to the chest. The person had died cowering in fear. A sickening feeling crept into Willa's chest. It was the dead body of the Padawan, the charred bones of his gripping fingers still clinging to his spear of power. He had run into his private rooms and blockaded his door to protect his precious human-made objects from the hands of the mob. He had gathered the looking glass and the other human-made things all around him, coveting them to the very end. He was so frightened of losing control of them that he would not leave, even as the smoke and fire came. The spear of power and the other metal objects had survived the fire. But he had not. She stared at what was left of her uncle for several seconds. And then she turned away. As she made her way out of the burned wreckage of the lair for the last time, she found a spot in the center of the destruction. She knelt down, dug into the ashes and dirt with her hands, and planted the tree into the ground.
I know, you don't want me to leave you here," she said gently. "But you just wait and see. You'll like this new spot when the sun rises, and the rains come, and the ashes wash down into the rivers. There will be plenty for your roots to grow into." After a few moments sitting with the little tree, she rose and started to walk away. She took a few steps. But then she stopped and turned and looked back at the tree, sitting so small and frail in the ashes all alone. "Maybe you don't have to wait," she thought. "Maybe I can give you a little bit of a head start, help you out, like you always did for me." She walked back over to the little tree and knelt down in the ashes in front of it. Then she touched her fingers to the tree's tiny roots and trunk, and she closed her eyes. At first, nothing happened, but then she began to softly sing the song that her mamma had taught her when she was 6 years old, the night her parents and sister died. The roots of the tree began to extend, reaching down into the ashes. "That's it, little one," she whispered. "Keep coming."
As the roots pulled the nutrients from the ashes of the past, the tree began to grow, its branches reaching upward and spreading outward, the leaves unfurling bright and green, and the trunk thickening as it reached toward the sky. It was a song of death and a song of life, of growth and rebirth, with words as ancient as the mist-filled forests. Soon the tree had grown as tall as she was, with its branches as wide as her outstretched arms.
"That's it, little one. Keep coming," she said again,
and the tree kept growing. It grew and grew until the trunk was thick, the branches strong, and the leaves reaching far above her. Willa smiled as the energy of the tree flowed through her body and her heart, and her own power flowed through the tree. And the moment she smiled, the branches above her head curled and turned and brightened into the shape of glittering flying birds, glowing with a bounty of blue ghost fireflies, their sparkling abundance reaching to the glistening starlit heavens above. She was sculpting like the Farron of old. When she was finally done, the magnificent, glowing tree stood more than 100 feet tall in the center of the ashen devastation that had once been Dead Hollow, the moon shining down through its branches and lighting up the world around her. Willa looked up at the tree and smiled with happiness.
"Well, it's a good start, little one. A very good start indeed," she said, her heart overflowing.
"I think you've got it from here." And only then, with the little tree settled into its new home, did she rise from her knees and walk away. Chapter 70. As Willa made her way out of the smoking devastation of the lair and went out into the nighttime forest, the magnitude of everything that had happened began to soak into her mind. The Padawan, the god of the clan, was dead. The ancient lair of her people had burned to the ground. Gredic would never be able to attack her again. Her fellow Yaders, her rivals and tormentors, were gone. And the clan was shattered, cast out into the winds of uncertainty, without shelter, without a leader to bind them together toward a common cause. She felt it all swirling inside of her. What had she done? Was she the one who had caused all this? Had she destroyed the Farron people? Too dismayed to take it all in, she just kept walking. A short time later, she came upon a Farron boy, a little bit older than her, wandering alone among the trees, a stunned look on his face. He was one of the few young Farron she'd ever seen who still had spots and streaks like she did, instead of mottled gray skin. He had been a Yaider like her and the others, but he had never tormented her, never stolen her take.
"Are you all right, Sacrum?"
she asked as she approached him, but he did not reply. And he did not look at her. A jagged cut dripped red down Sacrum's forehead. His shoulder was burned and bleeding. His hair was singed and his face was blackened with soot. The boy was mumbling to himself, but she couldn't understand him, and his eyes were glazed, as if he had taken in more than his mind could absorb.
"Sacrum, it's me, it's Willa," she said, touching his arm, trying to let him know she was there.
He did not resist her or pull away, but he did not respond to her either.
"I will help you," she said, taking his arm and leading him. "Let's go this way, toward the others."
As she and the lost boy walked along together, she wondered what kind of life they would lead now. In the chaos of a scattered clan, would this boy remain a Yaider like he had been before? Would Yaiders even continue to exist? Would this boy even survive the winter? Or was he one of those bees flying around looking for a hive that had been destroyed? She walked with Sacrum for nearly an hour, down the mountain, away from the last burning remnants of the Dead Hollow lair, following the tracks and disturbed leaves that told her that at least some of the other Farron of their clan had fled in this direction.
"Where is everyone?"
the boy asked blankly. She wasn't even sure if he was speaking to her or himself, or to someone who wasn't there.
"Where is everyone?"
he mumbled sadly again, repeating himself over and over again. She knew he needed help. He had seen too much, and he was suffering from clan shock. But if she could get him back to the others, then he might get through it. As she walked along through the forest with the boy, she came to the decision that she wouldn't just help him. She'd help gather all the members of the clan back together. That was what she needed to do, not just for the sake of the others, but for her own clan shock, which she knew was lodging deep in her leafy soul with every moment that passed. Now that the Padawan was gone, things were going to change. People were going to need help. They would need to relearn the ways of the forest. They would need to listen to their own hearts again and turn to each other, build families again. They would all need to work together, side by side, to make a better lair for themselves. She began to feel an unfamiliar kind of hope in her heart, the kind of hope that could only come after desolation, after destruction, a sense that maybe, just maybe, that which had forever been unchangeable was about to change. She picked up a scent in the air. "We're almost there, Sakram," she told the boy. "Some of the others from our clan are just up ahead. We'll get you some food and water, and you'll be able to see everyone, and you'll start feeling well again. It's all going to be all right." The boy's face did not change. It did not light up with hope, but his walking seemed to gain new strength and speed. Finally, she spotted a small group of 20 or 30 Farren in the forest ahead. Willa held the arm of the boy as she came upon them, just to make sure he stayed steady on his feet, and to show the others that she was a friend, not a foe. "I just wanted to make sure Sakram found his way," she said as she approached. "I've come to help in any way I can." At first, no one seemed to see her or hear her. They were just stumbling along, their eyes staring ahead or down at the ground. "I came to help," she said again, more loudly this time. One of the women looked up and then pointed at her and shouted, "There she is!"
"She's returned," said one of the men.
Willa's heart leapt that they recognized her and were welcoming her among them. She was part of the clan again. She led Sakram over to his mother. "I want to help in any way I can," Willa said. "We'll gather everyone together. We'll help each other forage for food and keep warm."
"We don't need your help,"
the boy's mother said, grabbing Sakram by the arm and yanking him away from her.
"Burner,"
one of the men hissed.
"Get out of here, burner," said another, scowling and then spitting at her. "We don't want you here."
"Destroyer,"
the first woman shouted. Willa stepped back, startled and confused, her heart sinking in despair.
"I didn't start the fire," she said, but they didn't seem to care.
Many of them had believed in her for a little while, and they had finally been able to see through Nalik's blend. They had swarmed around her and protected her. But most of her allies had been struck down by the Padawan's guards, and others had been swept up in the fear of the fleeing crowd. Fear follows fear. The Farren had lived in Dead Hollow for hundreds of years. It had been their protection, their way of life, their hive. And she had been the one who had clenched her fist and raised her voice. Without the lair, there would be no walls, no warmth, no protection, no clan. Not the way it was before. They didn't care what she had said or what she could do. They hated her. Then she saw one Yater girl coming forward through the group. Willa felt a rush of relief. Gillen was alive. Her face was smudged with soot marks, and her shoulder had been badly burned, but she looked as strong as ever, and she seemed as relieved that Willa had survived as Willa was that she had.
"Don't you see?" Gillen shouted out to the rest of the group. "Willa has done us a great service. She has defeated the Padawan."
"You want us to thank her for burning down our home?" one of the older Farron sneered.
"She's given us a new chance," Gillen said, her voice filled with hope and determination. "We are free. We'll start over. We'll build a new lair."
"Freedom is all fine and good until it snows," one of the other Farron said.
"Or we get hungry," someone said. "I'm hungry now."
"Willa is knowledgeable in the old ways," Gillen argued. "She can help us."
"She's a traitor against the clan," someone spat.
"Traitor," called another.
As Willa looked around her at all the faces, it surprised her that many of the older Farron in the group appeared to hate her even more than the others. She had hoped they would remember the Farron of old that her grandmother had taught her about, but instead they seemed the most set in their ways, the most angry that their lives had been disrupted. But she could see in the hopeful faces of some of the younger Farron that they understood that things could be different now, that a new kind of clan could be created. When she looked at her old friend, Gillen met her eyes with a brave and steady gaze. Willa could see it. Something had changed in Gillen. Something had kindled a new courage in her, and Willa knew there would be others like her.
"Now that the Padawan's gone," Willa said, trying to move toward her Farron kin, "we'll find a better way to live."
"Get out of here,"
one of the older Farron hissed and chattered his teeth at her.
"Burner,"
some of the others started screaming again.
"Burner."
"I came to help," Willa said,
but she could see that most of the clan was against her. It was clear that change would come soon. Gillen and the others would lead the clan anew. They would begin to find a better way. But Willa could see that very few wanted anything to do with her. Sakram's mother ran forward and pointed at her, her face wrinkled with revulsion.
"She's a clan breaker!"
the woman screamed. Gillen and several others tried to stop them, but it was no use. Many of the Farron hissed and shouted at Willa, and then some of the men picked up long sticks from the ground and charged at her. Others hurled stones. Willa ducked down and covered her head with her hands and arms as she ran away, the stones striking her ears and neck and shoulders with painful blows. She ran down into the narrow gully of a stream, scrambled beneath a fallen log, and curled into a shaking ball. Hiding in that dark little hole, she buried her face in her hands and wept. Chapter 71 Willa rubbed her eyes, then crawled out from beneath the log. She brushed the dirt and the centipedes and the little bits of bark from her hair and her arms, and looked around her. She had once again been cast from her clan. What was she going to do now? Where was she going to go? Should she howl for Luthien? Should she go back to the Sacred Lake of the Bears? Should she find the mother deer and fawn that she had met by the stream? She knew she had the knowledge and skill to live safely in the forest on her own for many years. But she also knew that a tree needed more than water and soil to survive. As she clambered out of the gully of the stream and came up onto a mound of high ground, she caught a glimpse of movement across the river. Her heart leapt. The black panther and a dark brown mountain lion were traveling along the edge of the river. The two big cats were moving quickly and with determination, traveling east, as if they were on a long journey over the mountain to some distant land. They were such beautiful and majestic beasts, filled with a power and confidence that amazed her. She could see that they had sustained wounds from some sort of battle, but the wounds didn't seem to be slowing them down. She was so glad to see the cats. She didn't know who or what they were, or why normally solitary animals were traveling the way they were, but she loved how they were together. "Goodbye, my friend," she whispered in the old language to the Black Panther, wishing her well wherever her journey would take her. After everything that had happened since the night she was shot, and as she watched the departing panther, she felt such a profound and aching loneliness, a sense that she was truly on her own now. But there was something about the panther that gave her hope as well. Hope in friendship, hope in alliance, hope in a future that she knew she could not yet imagine. She knew that she wasn't like the Black Panther. She wasn't fierce of heart or sharp of claw like many of her animal friends. She wasn't a leader or a fighter. She had never raised a weapon or struck a blow against anyone or anything, and she vowed that she never would. She was just a Faerun girl, a night spirit named Willa, trying to find her way. "Willa of the Wood," she said to herself, knowing a little better now exactly what that meant. She had said the words very quietly beneath her breath, but the moment she spoke them, the Black Panther stopped on the trail, turned its head, and looked across the river toward her. The panther's yellow eyes stared straight at her. Willa's normal instinct when she was spotted by a predator was to blend into her leafy surroundings and disappear. And it would have been easy to do here, easy to never be seen again. But that was not what she wanted. Her heart was beating heavily in her chest, but she held her blend back. She wanted the panther to see her. The panther gazed at her for a long time. Was the panther wondering where she'd come from and exactly what she was? Was the panther wondering if she would make a good ally in the fight against the dark and mysterious dangers of the world? Willa held the panther's gaze with her bright green eyes. "Willa of the Wood," she said again, and she smiled. She was a creature of the forest, with the lore and spirit of her grandmother within her. She spoke the old language and the new. She could sense the movement of the rivers and hear the whispers of the trees. And she thought that someday, just maybe, she and this panther might meet again. Chapter 72. As the hours passed, the smoky haze of midnight flames slowly gave way to the coming dawn, with Venus, the morning star, rising from the black silhouettes of the mountain ridges up into the dark blue of the glowing sky. As the sun began to rise from behind the great mountain, Willa's thoughts turned to the humans. She just hoped that in all the chaos and violence of the night, none of the guards or Yaders had found Cassius, Beatrice, or any of the other children as they fled through the forest and down the mountain. "Keep running," she thought to her young dayfolk friends. "Keep running all the way home." And then she thought about the last of the three human children to escape through the hole. "Follow the east side of the creek and look for a small cave in the rocks," she had told Hialeah. "Stay quiet and hidden until morning." She didn't know what she was going to do in the world now that the lair had been destroyed, or where she was going to go, but she wanted to finish the one thing she had begun, to make sure that Nathaniel's children made it home. She followed the creek toward the spot she had told them to hide. As she approached the area, her mind clouded with dark thoughts she couldn't control. She'd seen so much fighting and death. What if the children never made it to the hiding spot? What if they had been attacked or recaptured? When she saw Hialeah crouched near the crevice in the rocks, Willa's chest flooded with relief. She's there, Willa thought. She made it.
Hialeah had light brown skin and beautiful chestnut eyes, which made a striking combination as she stared out from the rocks, scanning the forest for danger. Her long, straight black hair fell evenly on either side of her face, and her mouth was set in a serious expression. Her plain brown dress was dirty from weeks of imprisonment and the trek down into the gully of the creek, and it was torn where she had used it to make a bandage for Willa's neck. But Hialeah looked strong and capable. Willa moved forward through the broken tumble of giant rocks until she was no more than a few steps from Hialeah, then slowly revealed herself, trying not to startle her. Hialeah's face immediately lit up.
"You made it," she said as she moved toward her.
It startled Willa when Hialeah wrapped her arms around her and pulled her close. Willa couldn't help but smile. Hialeah was probably her same age, but taller and stronger than her, and there was something invigorating about her embrace. It was a strange and glorious feeling to be held by this bold human girl, to feel the arms of her friendship around her.
"Thank you for saving me and my brothers," Hialeah said.
"You're welcome," Willa said happily. When they separated, Hialeah looked Willa over more closely, checking the bandage on her neck.
"The cut," Hialeah said in astonishment. "And your other wounds, they're almost healed."
"I got a little help from an old friend," Willa said.
"You came back!"
Iska said enthusiastically as he crawled out of the cave, holding his little brother by the hand.
"Shh, we're supposed to be hiding," Hialeah scolded him. "It's all right now," Iska insisted. "Willa's here. She'll protect us."
"I don't know if I can protect anyone," Willa started to say. But following his sister's lead, Iska leapt at Willa and embraced her, wrapping both his arms around her.
"During the night, we decided we weren't going to leave this cave until you got here."
Willa frowned and looked at him. "I told you that we wouldn't see each other again, that you should go home without me," she said in confusion.
"We saw the flames during the night," Iska said. "We knew something bad happened."
"We were worried about you," Hialeah said.
"I knew she'd make it," Iska said proudly and defiantly.
"No, you didn't," Hialeah contradicted him. "You were fretting about her all night. We all were. Even Inali was asking about you."
Willa was glad to see her friends were all right, and she was happy to see their smiling faces, but she knew they had a long way to go before they were home.
And she also knew that it was those same smiling faces that were going to change everything when the three children came back into their father's life. She felt as if her time with Nathaniel had been as rare and ethereal as the soft glow of the blue ghost fireflies on a long, dark night. But his reunion with his real children would be like the rise of the sun. The faint magic that had warmed Nathaniel's wounded heart for a little while would fade into nothingness in the brightness of the coming day. And she knew that with his children sleeping at night down the hall once more, the man Nathaniel would no longer have a need for a strange night spirit creature to be hanging in a woven cocoon from the ceiling in his room. She knew all of this, and it filled her with a wilting sadness, but she tried to stay strong in her heart, clinging to the idea that she had this one good thing in her life.
"I'll tell you the way home from here," Willa said. "The journey is long and difficult, but just keep following this creek until it meets the river, and then follow the river down into the valley."
"But we don't know the way,"
Iska said with a sudden firmness that surprised her. "If you follow the river, you won't get lost," Willa said. She knew she couldn't go with them. The pain would be too great. It was their home, not hers. The man Nathaniel was their father, not her father. She knew she couldn't bear to see them together as a family, as she had once been with Nathaniel.
and she couldn't bear to say goodbye to him again.
But what if someone attacks us along the way? Hialeah said, seeming to join in with her brother's sudden and bewildering stubbornness.
The night spirits have been scattered, Willa said. I don't think any of the guards and Yaders will be coming down here.
But they might, Iska said. They might be scouring the river, looking for easy prey.
They might be very angry about what happened last night and want revenge on any humans they find, Hialeah joined in.
If they find us, they'll kill us, Iska insisted,
nodding his head vigorously.
You've got to come with us, Willa.
I'm sorry, Iska. I can't, Willa said. The expression on Iska's face dropped in disappointment.
Why not?
He asked, his voice shaking with emotion.
Your father has been missing all of you terribly, she began uncertainly, looking at Iska, Hialeah, and Inali. But when he sees the three of you...
Her words dwindled off. She knew she didn't have an answer that she could explain to them. But as they all stared at her with their determined eyes, she could see they weren't going to give up.
All right, she said finally. I'll take you down the river into the valley. I'll get you home, and then we'll say goodbye.
Chapter 73. It would have normally been a 4-hour journey down into the valley, moving along the narrow edge of the river and climbing over the larger rocks, but with the three humans, it took much longer. Despite his initial enthusiasm, Iska struggled to keep up, and although Hialeah did not complain about carrying Inali mile after mile, Willa could see the girl was struggling.
I'll take him, Willa said,
gathering Inali into her arms, and the little human clung to her like a baby possum to his mama's fur. When she moved too fast or leapt to a particularly distant rock, Inali gripped her extra tight and whispered,
"Don't let me go,"
in her ear. The children made too much noise when they traveled. They talked loud, they walked loud, they breathed loud, and their monotone skin stuck out so conspicuously in the forest that it was a wonder that this species had ever survived their journeys through the world. She was sure that every predator in the area was going to hear their heavy, tromping feet and see their bright faces and arms. But on the other side of it, she liked how as soon as she took Inali into her arms, Hialeah began helping Iska up the steeper climbs, and sometimes Iska helped her in return. Brother and sister, making their way home. Humans weren't always born as twins like Farron were, but the bond was there. She could see it. As they traveled home, they came upon a pack of Yaders with sharpened spears scavenging along the bank of the river. Willa ducked down behind a rock with Inali and pulled Iska toward her.
"Shh,"
she whispered to Inali, touching his lips with her finger. Hialeah quickly pinned herself behind a pine tree.
Smart girl, Willa thought. She's learning quick.
Another time they saw a group of 6 loggers with axes and picks trudging along a path through the forest.
Just keep walking,
Willa told the men in her mind as she and the children hunkered down in the bushes beside the trail. Working together over the next few hours, they hid and they snuck. They ran and they climbed, until the spruce and firs of the mountain slopes began to give way to the leafy trees of the valley. Finally, she and the 3 children came to the pools of reflecting water that lay in the stones along the bank of the river. Willa remembered looking into these pools and seeing her face turn to stars on the night she was shot.
"We're here," she said softly to the others, not quite able to keep the sadness from creeping into her voice.
"She's right! This is our part of the river!"
Iska said excitedly, seeming not to notice her solemn tone.
"These are our rocks! We're almost home!"
As he said these words, Willa's heart filled with a slow and quiet sorrow. She knew she would soon be parting from her companions, and on her own again. They approached the house from the same direction Willa had that first night she came to fill her satchel.